Eddie, the Collegiate Junior. Chapter 7. Summer Break, Part 2. Since the Olympics have been over, Eddie has been spending a lot of time cleaning up around the service station. So far, over the past few weeks, Eddie has cleaned up the inside of the station, installed a hidden safe behind a movable wall in the private restroom, straightened up the office, and found a proper place for every tool. Finished with the inside of the service station, Eddie is now focusing on pressure washing the floors of the service bays and the outside of the station. While pressure washing the service bays, Eddie looks around at his setup, thinking that the place now looks brand new. Looking out of the service area, Eddie recalls that, at this point in time, Eddie took his second trip through the portal and saw the mechanic pressure washing the floor, as Eddie is doing now. Although he looks out toward the road several times, Eddie sees no sign of his younger counterpart coming from the past. Once the inside is pressure washed, Eddie moves on to working on the outside. Pressure washing the parking lot will take a few days, but once it is done, the service station will look more presentable. The afternoon goes by quickly, still with no sign of Eddie coming from the past. As the sun begins to set, Eddie closes up for the day, gets into his MGB, and heads home. Early during the next week, the sign, which reads Eddie's Service Station, arrives and is being installed by the sign company. Behind the service station, Mark is tying up a few loose ends regarding the storage building. Mark walks from behind the service station and tells Eddie, "Wow. It looks like everything's about done." Eddie replies, "Yeah, bro. I'm in business. I wanted to get this all finished before Kathy starts teaching." Mark mentions, "Yeah. By then, we'll be back on the track." Eddie replies, "I can't wait. The team is stronger than ever." Once the sign has been installed, Eddie and Mark call it an early day and head home. When Eddie gets home, Kathy is in the backyard, relaxing by the pool. Walking up, Eddie tells Kathy, "I've been cleaning up the station for a few weeks, and I'm finally done." Kathy exclaims, "Great. So, are you going to reopen soon?" Eddie replies, "Yeah. But, get this. I never came from the past. I distinctly remember coming to the future in August of this year. Everything happened just like it was supposed to, but I haven't come from the past yet." Kathy replies, "That's kind of weird. But, you didn't think that was going to happen." Eddie then explains, "Oh, and get this. When I went through the portal to 1980, I asked my future self about the angles of the rocks in the portal, and he, or I, knew a lot about it. But, I am at that time now, and we know that the portal gets its power from the blue, yellow, and red stones. But, he didn't know that back then." Kathy replies, "That's not too weird because, in that future, I probably wasn't alive. So, you never went looking for any more stones." Thinking for a moment, Eddie replies, "Wow, Katerina. It sounds like you have it all figured out." Eddie then contends, "So, if I'm not coming from the past, now I'm wondering why I even bothered to put in the safe." Kathy replies, "Well, for two reasons that I can think of. One is that it is supposed to be there. And the second is because you can keep money and gold in the safe and go into the future and sell gold." Eddie points out, "Yeah. But the portal is in our backyard." Kathy tells Eddie, "So, tell Mark to make another marble portal and install it behind the station. I think it would look really nice there." Eddie thinks for a moment and replies, "Yeah. That should be easy enough. I am definitely going to do that. Then, I can keep one of my bicycles at the station and buy and sell gold after work. After all, going into the future, dealing in gold and examining the future stock market pages is how Eddie makes his real money." A week later, the tribe meets at the county pool for their annual reunion. The reunion also brings the annual 100-yard freestyle rematch between Tessa and Eddie. Tessa is faster than she's ever been in the water. Eddie is making no comment this year about how he's been training, which is worrying Tessa to no end. While she says it's not really about the competition, Tessa has been taking this yearly rematch very seriously. As the morning moves on, everyone trickles in a few at a time. This year, there are 8 matching June buggies in the parking lot. Eddie has decided to leave his June buggy home and ride with Kathy. Bobby B and Erica arrive, with Erica driving Bobby B's June buggy. And, ready for the 100-yard freestyle rematch, Tessa arrives with Hoffa in her white June buggy. This year, Angela, from the radio station, was invited to join the group. Walking by Eddie's table, Tessa puts her stuff down on an adjacent table and greets Eddie, telling him, "You're going down this year, buddy." Eddie calmly replies, "Oh, well," leaving even greater uncertainty in Tessa's mind about the current level of Eddie's swimming skills. Looking around, Tessa searches for anyone who might tell her where Eddie stands. But Tessa reasons to herself that, if Eddie doesn't let on to her, then he likely hasn't told anyone whether he expects to win this year or not. Bobby B takes a seat next to Mark and, all excited, tells him, "Me and Erica found a lot for our house." Mark looks at Bobby B and asks, "Oh, really?" Bobby B replies, "Yeah. The sale goes through next week. And then, we're going to start building our house." Mark tells Bobby B, "Wow. It sounds like you'll be really busy for a few months." Beating around the bush, Bobby B asks Mark, "Do you think you'll have time to help me?" Messing with Bobby B, Mark replies, "Yeah. I suppose I can drive a few nails." Not quite the response he was expecting from Mark, Bobby B asks, "Where do I begin?" Mark replies, "Buying the lot would be a good place to start." Bobby B asks, "Then what?" Seeing that Bobby B is getting worried, Mark laughs and replies, "I'm messing with you. Yeah, I'll build your house for you. Don't worry about it. Just pick out the plans. I have a few plan books at home. Then, we'll get a building permit." Bobby B is greatly relieved. Although he learned a lot about construction from Mark, Mark made all the major decisions, and Bobby B was directed by Mark as to what to do. At a nearby table, a few of the women are discussing life after college. During the conversation, Karen asks Angela, who has graduated and now works at a television station, "Hey, how come the university's radio station is off the air?" Angela explains, "I was wondering that too. So, this morning, when I was getting ready, I called. They said the really bad thunderstorm yesterday damaged the antenna. Not only ours, but a few other stations got hit. Since we're a university, we're on the bottom of the list for the tower guys to get out and look at it." Karen, who listens to the campus radio station a lot, asks, "When will it be back on the air?" Angela replies, "They told me the tower guy can't get out for at least a week or two. And then he has to find out what the problem is." Kathy chimes in, half jokingly telling Angela, "I know a good tower guy." Angela asks, "Who's that?" Kathy replies, "Eddie." Angela exclaims, "That's right. Eddie offered to climb the tower and change the light bulb once." Eddie, at a nearby table, turns around and asks Kathy, "What are you signing me up for this time, Katerina?" Kathy replies, "Nothing. The campus radio station is off the air because the antenna got struck by lightning, and their tower guy can't get out for a week or two. And I was remembering about when you told Angela that you would climb the tower and change the bulb." Eddie asks Kathy, "So, when am I climbing this tower?" Angela looks at Kathy, discussing the situation between themselves. Kathy asks Eddie, "How about tomorrow morning?" Eddie replies, "Sure." Mark adds, "This sounds interesting. Can I come?" Eddie replies, "Sure. If I drop something when I'm up on the tower, I'll need someone to catch it." Angela walks over, giving Eddie and Mark a high five, and tells them, "I'll let Tim, the chief engineer, know. I'm sure he'll be really happy to hear this. Eddie curiously asks Angela, so, no one at the radio station can climb the tower? Angela replies, nope. No one there is physically fit enough. Most of the guys are a bunch of geeks. So, the station hires a tower maintenance company. So, tomorrow morning, the newly formed antenna crew will try to discover what went wrong causing the campus radio station to go off the air. About an hour before lunch, Tessa is getting a bit nervous. Wanting to get the race over with, Tessa asks Eddie, are you ready? Eddie confidently replies, whenever you are. Also quite confident, Tessa tells Eddie, okay. Let's get this over with. Imitating Tessa from last year, Eddie stands up, stretches his arms and, faking a yawn, tells Tessa, okay. I think I'm awake enough. Let's go and get this over with. I'm getting hungry. Eddie then yells out to Kathy, it's race time. Kathy walks over to Andrea, telling her that Eddie and Tessa are ready to race. Andrea, who graduated this year with a master's degree, is likely in her last summer of being a lifeguard at the county pool. Sherry, the other lifeguard on duty today, is still in college and will likely be the head lifeguard next year. With no one else racing this year, Eddie and Tessa get warmed up as Andrea blows her whistle, announcing that the pool will be closed for 10 minutes. The pool slowly clears out as the tribe moves to the pool's edge, since everyone wants a good view of the race. Clearing the pool takes a while, with some of the younger kids whining like their universe is coming to an abrupt end. Andrea, the lifeguard, tells everyone to get ready. Eddie takes lane 3 and Tessa takes lane 4. Walking along the edge of the pool, Sherry keeps the spectators back 3 feet from the pool's edge. Andrea asks Eddie and Tessa if they are ready. They both indicate they are, and Andrea walks to the side of the pool, ready to start the race. Andrea announces, "Take your mark." With everyone in position, Andrea blows her whistle, starting the race. Eddie and Tessa dive in with ferocity, each not knowing what the other has under the hood. Both swimmers get off to a strong start in what looks to be a performance beyond what everyone expected. Kathy mentions to Paula, Eddie thinks he's going to win this year. Paula replies, they are halfway through the first lap and he's ahead. At the wall first is Eddie, whose performance today is telling Tessa she needs to crank it up a notch or two. During the second lap of the four-lap race, Angela tells Kathy, I feel like I should be calling the play-by-play. Kathy asks, how is the job coming? Angela replies, great. I thought I would be stuck doing the evening news, but they put me on the sports coverage team. So, when the football season starts, I'll be down on the field. Kathy gives Angela a high five, telling her, awesome, girl. Angela replies, I had no idea I wanted to be a sportscaster until I worked the divisional meet last spring. As Eddie completes his second flip turn, Kathy mentions, it looks like Eddie is still ahead. Tessa touches the wall second and is not the least bit happy. Barbara walks over to Kathy and casually mentions, Eddie changed his stroke. Kathy explains, yeah, he did. He had me time him in our pool a few times. He changed his stroke a little to use a few more of his muscles. Barbara observes, it looks like a perfectly legal freestyle stroke. I can see exactly what he's doing differently. When Tessa finds out, she's going to get herself into a tizzy. Kathy replies, Eddie will tell her about it after the race is over. At the end of the third lap, Tessa makes up a little ground, but not enough to worry Eddie. With Eddie having a greater than usual lead, Tessa has a lot of work ahead of her in the final lap. Early in the last lap, Eddie still maintains the lead. Tessa gains slowly on Eddie as the end of the race draws near, but it's difficult to tell whether Eddie is taking it easy or Tessa has a second wind. With all eyes on the finish, everyone cheers as Eddie approaches the wall and touches first. Beating Tessa by more than 5 yards, Eddie is this year's clear winner. Barbara announces, "The winner this year is Eddie." In the pool, Tessa gives Eddie a high five, exclaiming, "Out with it. You have more secrets, buddy, and I want to hear them." Eddie tells Tessa, after lunch, "I'm hungry." Eddie and Tessa get out of the pool and join the others who are heading toward the concession stand. Over lunch, Tessa asks Eddie, "So, what's different this year?" Eddie explains, "I changed the way I do my stroke. I have my arms out a little farther from my body. This way, when I make the stroke, I can use my lats more, and I can also use my obliques by contracting that side of my body." Barbara reassures Tessa, "I was watching Eddie. His modified freestyle stroke is fully legal." Eddie adds, "The front crawl with a flutter kick is generally accepted as the freestyle stroke. But as long as it's clearly not a butterfly, breaststroke, or any variation of a backstroke, technically anything would be considered a freestyle. So, Kathy timed me in the pool using a few different variations to the stroke. I got it down to a science. Oh, and I was still training in my clothes to create drag in the water." Tessa tells Eddie, "You'll have to show me." Eddie replies, "Sure. But my variation may not give you any additional speed in the water. It will depend on how strong your other muscles are." Over lunch, Mark whispers to Eddie that the stone yard has cut the marble slab for the portal behind the service station and that it is ready for installation. Eddie tells Mark to bring it by any time and they'll install it. Eddie also mentions to Mark that, for the time being, the storage building behind the service station will be a gym. Erica mentions to Eddie that she wants a dune buggy. Eddie tells Erica that he'll build her one, but between her and Bobby B, they have a dune buggy and two motorcycles, neither of which are practical in the winter nor when it's raining out. Tessa takes Eddie's advice and will drive Bobby B's dune buggy a bit more. While everyone is together, Johnson tells everyone, "I have an announcement to make." Already knowing what Johnson is going to announce, Barbara smiles. Everyone gets quiet, and Johnson announces, "I got a job teaching physical education at the high school. And I'm going to be the assistant track coach." Cheers and clapping break out, catching the attention of everyone at the pool. Eddie sits back, thinking about one of his trips to the future when the chiropractor who supplies Eddie's vitamins once made reference to Coach Johnson. Eddie clearly sees the future falling into place, with a few slight modifications. After lunch, Kathy tells Karen, "You've been really quiet today. What's up?" Karen replies, "Nothing really." Kathy, perceiving something is wrong, tells Karen, "Something's up, girl. If you want to talk about it, let me know." A tear falls from Karen's eye, and she tells Kathy, "Can we go for a walk?" Kathy replies, "Sure," and Kathy and Karen walk to the other side of the pool where they can be alone. Seeing Karen is upset, Kathy asks, "So, what's up?" Karen explains, "I took biology 202 this past semester." Kathy interjects, "Yeah. Genetics and molecular biology, and that sort of stuff." Karen continues, "Yeah. And the professor went over blood types. My mother has blood type AB negative, so they are always asking her to donate." Karen starts crying and, through her tears, tells Kathy, "Mine is type O." Knowing what this means, Kathy gives Karen a hug, whispering to her, "Oh, hun, I'm so, so sorry." Once Karen composes herself, Kathy then asks, "Are you sure yours is type O?" Karen replies, "Yeah. I always knew it was." Then, in biology lab, we typed our own blood, and mine was definitely type O. Kathy suggests, "Maybe your mother's blood type isn't type AB." Karen replies, "It is. They are always asking her to donate. Once, she was even called in on Christmas Eve 1 year for an emergency." Kathy reiterates, "I am so sorry." Karen replies, "Now, I'm wondering who my biological parents are." Kathy replies, "Ask your mother. She would know." Karen replies, "Someday, I'm going to do that." Karen then explains, "At least, now I know why she always hated me. I'm either hers by someone else, or I was adopted. Or maybe I was switched at birth. I hope I was adopted." Kathy comments, "That would definitely explain a lot." Kathy then asks, "How much older than you are your brothers?" Karen replies, "One is 3 years older than me, and the other one is 1 year older than me." Kathy sighs and tells Karen, "Well, they probably wouldn't know anything. They would be 1 and 3 years old at that time. Kids that age think the stork delivers babies." Karen replies, "I'm guessing the stork brought me." Karen tells Kathy, "I need a really big favor." Kathy asks, "What's that?" Karen explains, "When I go home and ask my mother for an explanation, she's going to blow up. Will you please come with me?" Kathy replies, "Sure. No problem." Karen tells Kathy, "Thank you. If someone else is there with me, she doesn't dare explode like she usually does. She's like a nuclear weapon with a short fuse." Kathy replies, "Yeah. I've kind of seen that." Kathy and Karen talk for a while longer, then rejoin the group, walking into the middle of Brayden telling a story from the police academy. With Kathy and Karen walking up, Eddie tells Brayden, "Yo, bro. Start over, so that Kathy and Karen can hear the story." Starting from the beginning, Brayden explains, "When I was at the police academy, in one of our classes, the instructor was going over what to look for in a crowd situation that could pose a problem. He said that certain red flags would be evident, and if we see any red flags, we should pay close attention to those people. So, one of the recruits raised his hand and asked, 'When we see these red flags, where will they be? Will they be hiding them in their pockets, or will they be holding them out in the open?' Everyone at the tables laughs hysterically, not believing that anyone can be that dumb." Johnson comments, "No one can be that stupid." Brayden exclaims, "Oh yeah, they can. This guy was. Lucky for all of us, he didn't make it. His ass was dumber than the Chucky." Mark comments, "Well, I'm glad he didn't make it." Paula replies, "Yeah. If he did make it, you'd probably carry a big supply of red flags in your truck just to mess with him." Mark laughs and tells Paula, "Yeah. You never know when you need to mark underground utilities." Returning the subject of the dumb recruit, Johnson asks, "Did he get kicked out, or did he fail?" Brayden replies, "He failed. But they did kick another guy out." Johnson asks, "Why did the other guy get kicked out?" Brayden explains, "He had a really shitty attitude. He was always asking questions like, 'How much does an officer make?' or 'What's a detective's salary?' The commander told him, 'Son, if money is your only goal, you're in the wrong place. A police officer's duty is to protect and serve.' The commander explained to us, 'To become a police officer is a calling, not a job. A job is something you choose. A calling is something God chooses for you to do.' So, the commander kicked that guy's ass out of the academy and told him to go get a job washing police cars." Mark laughs, repeating, "That's kind of funny. Washing police cars." Mark glances over toward the other end of the pool and comments, "Talking about red flags, 3 red flags are over near the concession stand." Eddie asks, "What are they doing here?" Mark replies, "I don't know. I'm surprised they are still alive." Brayden comments, "Maybe they are here for their annual ass kicking." Chucky, Donna Harmon, and Terry Haynes disappear from view, prompting a few members of the tribe to occasionally glance over behind the restroom building, warding off a potential sneak attack. Brayden continues talking about the police academy, explaining, "When we were at the shooting range, one recruit came up and..." Suddenly interrupting himself, Brayden exclaims, "Something's going down over there." Brayden jumps up out of his seat and runs over to the concession area, followed by Bobby B, just in case Chucky needs to be dumped into a dumpster. Before Braden arrives at the scene, Erica, who was waiting in line at the concession stand to get a drink, carries Haynes on her back and dumps her into the pool. Going back for more trash, Erica drags Donna Harmon along the concrete, also dumping her in the pool. Perceiving that neither Haynes nor Harmon entered the pool voluntarily, Andrea blows her whistle and tells everyone to get out of the pool. With Erica having the situation under control, Braden and Bobby B let her finish her business. The crowd stands back as Erica heads straight on for Chucky. Placing Chucky into an arm lock, Erica guides Chucky toward the deep end of the pool, followed by Braden and Bobby B. Chucky screams out, "Someone, stop her! Help! Someone, stop her!" No one dares to come to Chucky's aid. At the deep end of the pool near the tribe's tables, Erica kicks the shit out of Chucky as the tribe sits back, watching the entertainment. After suffering many solid blows, Erica takes Chucky down. Mark comments, "That was a good two-point takedown. Had this been an actual wrestling match, the referee would have stopped the competition by now." Once Erica has decided that Chucky has had enough, Erica lifts Chucky off the ground and tosses him into the deep end of the pool. Mark yells out to Chucky, "Hey, Junior. The pool's closed. Didn't you hear the lifeguard?" Sherry runs over, diving into the deep end to save Chucky, who cannot swim. Mark mentions to Eddie, "Well, this afternoon didn't go exactly as planned." Eddie replies, "Yeah. I'd go and help out Erica, but it looks like she has everything under control." Erica runs back over to the shallow end, prompting Mark to tell Eddie, "I'm going to see what's going on over there." Mark and Eddie follow Erica, followed by a few others. At the shallow end, Andrea just pulled Haynes out of the water. Erica lifts Haynes off the ground, finishing the job she started earlier. Eddie exclaims, "Wow. Erica is really taking care of business today. I wonder what happened." Mark replies, "And it doesn't look like she's stopping." Seeing Haynes now donating blood to the environment, Andrea yells out to Erica, "Please don't throw her back in the pool. She's bleeding." For some reason, Andrea does not care that Erica is relentlessly kicking the shit out of Haynes. Andrea just does not want Haynes' blood in the pool, which would cause her to close the pool until it is safe to reopen. Once Erica is finished with Haynes, she moves on to kicking the shit out of Donna Harmon. Bobby B stands by, making sure no harm comes to Erica. Meanwhile, Braden is having a conversation with Andrea, attempting to find out exactly what happened. Daria, one of the concession stand attendants, joins in the discussion and, referring to Haynes, explains, "The one laying on the ground pulled a gun on the girl kicking the shit out of everyone." Shocked and surprised, Braden interrupts and asks, "Where's the gun now?" Daria replies, "The girl that's kicking the shit out of everyone took the gun away from her and threw it on the roof. It all happened so fast." Braden, looking on the roof of the concession stand and seeing the gun, is relieved that there is not a loaded weapon laying around. Pointing to Erica, Braden tells Daria, "By the way, that's Erica who's taking care of business." Braden then asks Daria, "What happened next?" Daria replies, "Erica went berserk." Stating the obvious, Braden comments, "And it looks like to me that she ain't done yet." Andrea tells Braden, "One of the other employees called the police." Braden replies, "Good." Andrea whispers to Braden, "Considering what happened, I'm just letting them fight." Giving Andrea some words of wisdom, Braden whispers back, "Yeah. You don't want to get in the middle of that one. Someone might get hurt. Breaking up that kind of ass kicking is way above your pay grade." Once Erica is finished taking apart Donna Harmon, she walks back to the tables, where Chucky is laying on the ground. Erica takes a seat with the tribe, where everyone asks her, "What happened?" Erica explains, "Haynes pointed a gun at me and told me, 'You're coming with us.' So, I disarmed her, threw her gun on the roof, and threw her and that other bitch in the pool. Then, I kicked the shit out of the Chucky. And then, I went back and finished the other two off. Chucky, who cannot swim, finally finds the energy to stand up and, seeing the tribe, attempts to get out of the immediate area. Erica gets out of her seat and forcefully kicks Chucky back into the water, causing Sherry to get back to work. Mark again yells out to Chucky, "Yo, Junior. Didn't you hear the lifeguard? The pool's closed." Erica takes her seat again, continuing her explanation of what happened. Braden walks back to the tables from the concession area and announces, "Those two don't look too good." Haynes is still out, and her hand looks all mangled up. Hearing the news, Barbara, a certified CPR instructor, walks over to the shallow end to investigate. As Sherry tows Chucky to the shallow end, Eddie comments, "The Chucky doesn't look too good either. He's crying like a baby." Hoffa mentions, "The lifeguard had a hard time getting the Chucky out of the pool. We had to help her." And after helping Sherry get Chucky out of the water, Andrea reopens the pool. Erica asks Braden, "Am I in trouble?" Braden laughs and replies, "Not if they pointed a gun at you. Their asses are the ones that are in trouble." Erica is relieved, thinking that she perhaps went a bit too far kicking the shit out of her three adversaries. Erica sits back and relaxes, looking over the carnage she left behind. The police arrive at the scene. Erica is glad to see that Officer Richard Hayes has taken the call. Driving up behind Officer Hayes today is Officer Daniel Wilson. Evaluating the situation, Officer Wilson radios for an ambulance. Officer Hayes speaks with Andrea, who brings Daria into the conversation, getting an understanding of what happened. Hearing that Erica is involved and a gun was also involved, Officer Hayes instructs Officer Wilson to get in touch with Captain Gabriel. Officer Hayes walks over to the tables where the tribe is seated, seeing the familiar crowd. Calling Erica and Braden aside, Officer Hayes gets their statements. Erica is quite relieved to know that her father is on the way. Informed that a gun was involved, Officer Hayes, Braden, and Erica walk back to the concession area, where Haynes still has not regained consciousness. Seeing the gun on the roof, Officer Hayes asks the person behind the concession stand, "Is there a ladder around somewhere?" The attendant replies, "Not that I know of." Braden tells Officer Hayes, "I can get the gun down." Braden retrieves the rescue hook from the fence, which is on a very long pole. Placing the hook behind the gun, Braden slowly slides the gun to the edge of the roof. With the gun just beyond Officer Hayes' reach, Braden gets a chair from a nearby table. Standing on the chair, Officer Hayes retrieves the gun. Taking a look at the gun, Braden exclaims, "That's a 45. Holding the gun by the barrel, Officer Hayes tells Braden, "From the weight of it, I'd say it's fully loaded. But it's locked out." Well, this one is going to put these characters away for a very long time. Erica is certainly glad to hear that, and so is Braden. Two ambulances arrive, and the paramedics attend to Chucky, Haynes, and Harmon. Officer Hayes informs the paramedics that Haynes is under arrest. Haynes, who is still unconscious, is placed on a stretcher and transported to the hospital. Officer Hayes places Harmon and Chucky under arrest, and they are also transported to the hospital. Once they are released from the hospital, they'll all be transported to jail. Captain Gabriel arrives and is briefed by Officer Hayes of the situation. Calling Erica over, Captain Gabriel, Erica's father, asks her, "What happened?" Erica explains, "Haynes pointed a gun at me, and she told me, 'You're coming with us.' So, I disarmed her and kicked the shit out of all of them. And I made sure that bitch can never fire a gun for the rest of her life." Captain Gabriel is certainly glad to see that Erica can protect herself, for he taught her well. Hearing that Haynes was armed, Captain Gabriel tells Officer Hayes, "Make sure this one is well documented. I want those three put away for the maximum." Officers Hayes and Wilson get everyone's statements, making an airtight case against Haynes and her accomplices. The police department clearly wants Haynes, Chucky, and Harmon off the street for many reasons. Now, with a felony charge against Haynes, Chucky, and Harmon, the police finally have a chance to accomplish that goal. Captain Gabriel, who is not on duty today, stays for a while and enjoys a slice of pizza with the tribe. The disruptions of the afternoon do not get in the way of this year's cannonball contest, which Bobby B. has been waiting for. Captain Gabriel stays around for the competition, wanting to see his future son-in-law in action. This year's contestants are Eddie, Mark, Braden, and Bobby B. Suffering a loss last year to Braden, Bobby B. is out to regain his title of the Cannonball King. Before they start, Mark asks Bobby B., "So, still no rules, bro?" Bobby B. replies, "No rules. And, this year, I'm going to win." Mark reminds Bobby B., "That's what you said last year." Bobby B. replies, "Yeah, but I weigh more this year, and I have a method." As in previous years, Kathy, Paula, and Barbara will be the judges and get into position. Bobby B. announces, "I'm going first." Heading to the diving board, Bobby B. has apparently been exploring new techniques. Taking a few check bounces, Bobby B. carefully plans his trajectory and landing point. Distracting Bobby B., Mark yells out, "Hey, that diving board only holds 300 pounds. Bobby B., however, is not fazed in the least by Mark's comment. Using the same strategy as Braden did last year, Bobby B. takes 3 bounces on the diving board and, getting as much altitude as he can, takes off toward the edge of the pool. With a great landing in the water, Bobby B.'s splash goes quite far. Standing in the midst of the tables where the tribe is seated, Kathy announces, "The splash went all the way to here." Akinmola attests to Bobby B.'s skill, announcing, "That was a good one. I got wet." Bobby B. comes out of the water, confident that, this year, he won. Eddie goes second and, like last year, decides to use the diving board technique. Eddie reasons that, if he is to beat Bobby B., he must get more altitude off the diving board. Eddie takes 4 bounces, getting as much altitude as he can. Taking off toward the edge of the pool, Eddie enters the pool at an angle, making a huge splash toward the tables. Kathy gets wet, searching for the farthest splash. Kathy and Barbara stand at the point of Eddie's farthest splash. Barbara announces, "On my side, Bobby B. is still in first place." Kathy finds Eddie's farthest splash and announces, "Same here. Bobby B. is in first place." Mark goes third. Using the running technique this year, Mark gets a running start. With more speed, Mark is able to land into the water with more force. Mark flies through the air and enters the pool on a shallow angle. This year, Mark's splash goes farther than expected. Searching for the farthest splash from the pool's edge, Paula announces, "The splash made it to here." After a discussion among the judges, Mark is in second place. Using the technique he used last year, Braden gets on the diving board, ready to defend his title. Braden takes 3 bounces and, leaving the diving board, lands close to the edge of the pool. Making a huge splash, Braden wonders whether he won. When Braden emerges, he hears Kathy announcing, "Bobby B.'s splash went farther." After a short discussion among the judges, Barbara announces, "This year, Bobby B. is the winner." Mark came in second place. Braden came in third place. And Eddie came in fourth place. Regaining his title, Bobby B. receives high fives, congratulations, and a slice of pizza. Seeing that Mark actually beat him using a different technique, Eddie decides to revise his technique for next year. As the afternoon winds down, everyone heads to the pizzeria. On the way, Kathy tells Eddie, "It's kind of weird how Chucky seems to always know where to find us. It's like he's stalking our group, or something." Eddie replies, "Yeah. This is no longer coincidental." Kathy sighs and mentions, "Well, At least those three assholes are out of commission for a while. Bright and early the next day, Eddie, Kathy, Mark and Paula head to the campus radio station. Tim, who will be a senior at the university this upcoming year, and chief engineer of the radio station, is waiting with Angela. When Eddie and his newly formed tower crew arrive, Angela introduces them to Tim. Following introductions, Angela tells Tim, these guys are all track athletes. They want to have a race to the top of the tower. So, I told them it was okay. Tim laughs, telling Angela, I know you. You're not getting me with that one. Kathy tells Tim, she's serious. We want to have a race to the top. And I'm going to win. Now looking worried, Tim replies, that's way too dangerous. Knowing exactly what Kathy is up to, Paula comments, darn. We never get to have any fun. In a serious tone, Tim informs Angela, I can't allow them to race up the tower. Angela laughs, telling Kathy and Paula, wow. We triple-teamed him and got him good. Tim sighs and comments, some things never change. She's been at this for as long as I can remember. Tim gathers the equipment, and they head to the roof of the building where the antenna tower is located. Since Eddie does not know exactly what he is looking for, Tim explains, there are 8 bays to the antenna. I suspect lightning hit one of them because the SWR is 1.4 to 1. It should be 1.05 to 1 or less. So, I'm guessing something up there got hit by lightning. If you can find out which bay is the problem, then you can disconnect the coaxial cable and unbolt it and lower it down. Then, we can send it off to get repaired. Eddie asks, how would I know if there is a problem? Tim replies, if lightning hits something up there, it will look like a real shitty arc welding job. You can't miss it. And check the coax cables. If they got hit, the outer jacket will be melted. Eddie replies, got it. Angela asks Tim, how long would it take to fix it? Tim replies, probably about a month. Angela asks, so, you'll be off the air for a whole month? Tim replies, no. If a bay is damaged, we can run at reduced power. But Eddie would have to disconnect 4 of the bays from the power divider to keep the load balanced. Mark comments, this all sounds complicated. Angela tells Mark, I suppose that's why Tim is the chief engineer. After some detailed instruction, Eddie begins climbing the antenna tower. With 2 safety harnesses on, Eddie takes 2 steps up the tower, moves 1 D-ring up 2 rungs, then moves the other D-ring up 2 rungs. The fastest man in the world is climbing an antenna tower at about 10 feet per minute. 10 feet per minute would be equivalent to a 30-minute 100-yard dash, about the top speed of Chucky after Erika took care of him yesterday. Arriving at the first antenna bay, Eddie examines it and yells down, I can't see anything wrong with this one. Tim yells back, good. Lightning would most likely hit one of the top bays. The problem is probably at the top. Looking far up the tower, Eddie yells back, thanks. Climbing higher, Eddie finds no problems with the second, third, or fourth bays of the antenna either. On his way to the fifth bay, Eddie yells down, I found your problem. Tim asks, what's that? Eddie yells back, this big thing, whatever it is all melted on the top, and it has a hole in it. Tim mumbles under his breath, shit. That's the power divider. Having the power divider hit by lightning is a worst-case scenario. The custom-made power divider is the most expensive item on the antenna tower. Knowing that the power divider has to come down, Tim yells up at Eddie, do you think you can remove it? Eddie replies, yeah. Tim yells out, instructing Eddie, okay. Clamp the pulley onto the tower, and we'll send the tools up to you. In the meantime, start disconnecting all the cables. Eddie disconnects the coaxial cables and Heliac's transmission line as he awaits the arrival of his tools. 10 minutes later, Eddie attaches the power divider to the rope and the power divider is lowered down. Tim tells Eddie to leave the pulley attached to the tower, since the power divider will have to be reinstalled at a later date. Eddie descends the tower, not much faster than he climbed it. Arriving at the base of the tower, Eddie announces, "That was an easy workout." Announcing the bad news, Tim explains to everyone, "This is the problem, all right. Lightning hit the power divider. And it's a worst-case scenario. We'll be running at low power for a month." Mark examines the power divider and asks, "Why?" "This seems like it would be easy to fix." Eddie takes a closer look and confidently replies, "Yeah. I can have this fixed in an hour." The 16-inch removable aluminum plate at the top of the power divider, which got hit by lightning, has an irregular hole in it, which allowed rain to enter. Tim asks Eddie, "You can?" Eddie replies, "Yeah. Let's take it over to the shop, and I'll fix it." With nothing to lose, Tim gathers a few spare connectors, a soldering iron, and a few other items in the event that something inside needs to be repaired. The group heads to Eddie's service station, where the master mechanic will attempt to repair something he knows absolutely nothing about. At the service station, Eddie removes the aluminum top to the power divider. Finding a piece of aluminum in the shop, Eddie and Kathy machine a new part, as Tim examines the inside of the power divider. Tim finds the inside of the power divider was splattered with molten aluminum when lightning struck it. With a cutting wheel, Mark carefully cleans out the inside of the power divider, removing the blemishes, restoring it to factory specifications. Tim is quite amazed that Eddie and Mark make repairing the power divider look so easy. Paula tells Tim, "You're in trouble now. Kathy's working, and she doesn't work free." Tim asks, "Really? How much does Kathy charge?" Paula replies, "A pizza." "This is definitely going to cost you a pizza. And there ain't no way you're getting out of it." Tim thinks to himself that, if Eddie can repair the power divider, a pizza is a small price to pay. And besides, the pizza would come out of the radio station's budget, so Tim doesn't really care. In 20 minutes, Eddie and Kathy have the new part completed. Eddie and Tim reassemble the power divider, and 5 minutes later, it's ready to be reinstalled. Tim hesitantly asks Eddie, "Is there any chance that I can get you to reinstall it?" Eddie replies, "Sure. No problem." Kathy adds, "You can install it after lunch. It's pizza time." Paula looks at Tim and mentions, "See that? What did I tell you?" Kathy asks Paula, "See what?" Paula explains, "When you guys were running that machine over there, I told Tim that you were working, so it's going to cost him a pizza." Kathy smiles and laughs, replying, "Well, it's lunchtime." The group heads out to the pizzeria for lunch before they return to the university to finish the repairs. After lunch, the first order of business is to get the radio station back on the air. Eddie climbs the tower again, reinstalls the power divider, and makes the long trek back down the tower. When he gets down from the tower, Eddie asks Tim, "How much does that part cost, anyway?" Tim replies, "About $5,000. It was custom made for our frequency and antenna configuration." Eddie replies, "Wow. I'm glad I didn't drop it." The group heads inside, where Tim will attempt to turn on the transmitter. Walking into the transmitter room, Angela explains to the tower crew, "This large cabinet, with all the switches and meters, is our transmitter." As Tim flips a circuit breaker on the front panel, causing the transmitter to come to life, Karen comments, "Tim is secretly hoping that the transmitter won't blow up when he turns it on." As he is pressing the button labeled filaments, Tim laughs and tells the group, "Don't listen to her. She's messing with you again." Karen replies, "Don't listen to him. There's always a first time for everything, and who knows what else the lightning did." Waiting for the tubes to warm up, Tim assures everyone, "Trust me. Nothing is going to blow up." Everyone knows by now that Angela, like Mark, is a master of messing with people. After a few minutes, Tim presses the button labeled plates, which powers up the transmitter. Looking at the meters, Tim comments, "Well, that looks good." Tim tells Angela, "Turn on the exciter and let's see what happens." Angela walks over to the exciter and Tim whispers to the tower crew, "I'm going to get her good. Don't get scared." Tim watches the meters carefully and, as Angela turns on the exciter, Tim, as loud as he can, yells out, "Pow." Suddenly startled, Angela jumps back, quickly knowing that Tim got her, and got her good. Angela tells Tim, "Okay. You won this one." Kathy asks, "So, is the station back on the air?" Tim replies, "Yeah. The SWR is back to 1.04 to 1, and the plate voltage and current are where they are supposed to be. And the transmitter didn't blow up. That's always a good sign. Thank you guys so much. I can't tell you how much I appreciate this." Angela asks Tim, "Do you want me to sign us on?" Tim replies, "Sure. And now that we're back on the air, I'll see you can get over here to man the station." Kathy interjects, "I can sign us on." Angela, knowing exactly where this is going, tells Kathy, "That's right. You can sign us on. Let's do this." As everyone walks into the main part of the radio station, Tim wonders what Angela and Kathy are up to. Tim powers up the automation equipment and, knowing that no one is listening to a radio station that has been off the air for 2 days, tells Angela, "You guys can go ahead and sign us on now." Tim makes a few phone calls, trying to find someone to come down to the station and work the afternoon shift. Angela and the tower crew head to the studio. Angela tells Kathy, "Okay. You can sign us on now." Kathy sits behind the console and, recalling what she learned when Braden had his interview with Angela, pushes the button labeled air. Angela tells Kathy, "Wow. Awesome. You found the magic button." Mark, Eddie, and Paula stand aside, watching as Kathy figures out what to do next. Giving Kathy a little help, Angela instructs Kathy, "Push the button labeled in on the input labeled mic 1, and then announce our call letters and the city." Kathy pushes the button and, as instructed, announces the university radio station's call letters and the city. Angela gives her a thumbs up and whispers, "Good. We're signed on. Now, talk to everyone." Kathy announces, "Good afternoon, everyone. We are back on the air. Lightning hit the antenna tower 2 days ago and damaged the power divider. We spent the whole morning repairing the power divider, and we just got it working again. And now I have absolutely no idea which button to press next, so I'm going to keep pressing buttons until I hear some music." Angela giggles and tells Kathy, "Push the button labeled automation. It's next to the one labeled air." Kathy pushes the button, switching control back to the automation equipment. Hearing music start to play through the open door, Kathy exclaims, "Awesome. It worked." Angela tells Kathy, "That was really great." Angela and the tower crew walk out to the main part of the radio station, where Tim is entering information into the official station log. Angela asks Tim, "Did you find anyone to work?" Tim replies, "Yeah. Pat is on her way. It's her shift anyway. She can spend the afternoon calling everyone and let them know we're back on the air." Tim again thanks Eddie and his tower crew, also informing them, "If you guys didn't fix the power divider for us, we'd be running 10 watts out of one bay for a month. That signal would barely make it off campus. That would be really terrible, since classes start soon." Curiously, Angela asks, "How would you do that?" Tim explains, "The exciter puts out 10 watts. We can run off the exciter alone and transmit from one bay. All it would take is running a coaxial cable from the exciter to the bay." Angela announces, "And ladies and gentlemen, that's why Tim is our chief engineer." Eddie tells Tim, If you need any more work done, call me. Tim replies, I might just take you up on that. As Tim awaits Pat's arrival, everyone else heads out for the afternoon. Shortly after the annual get-together at the pool, Bobby B. begins working at Eddie's service station. Driving in on his BSA Starfire motorcycle, Bobby B. is ready to expand his horizons. Learning a lot from Mark, Bobby B. is ready to explore being an auto mechanic. Opening a little early on Bobby B.'s first day, Eddie shows him around the station, explaining what he will be doing. Mid-morning, Eddie is working on an engine, and Bobby B. is doing an oil change. Eddie yells out to Bobby B., here comes trouble. Bobby B. looks out toward the pumps as Eddie explains, that's Jimmy O'Brien. The car he's driving is the McCrutchen of automobiles. Bobby B. replies, I'll go see what he wants. Eddie explains, he wants his tank filled, and he's going to ask you about a half dozen things that are wrong with that piece of shit. And then he's not going to want anything fixed because it's too expensive. Bobby B. laughs, commenting, this should be fun. As Bobby B. walks up, O'Brien demands, fill it up with regular. Bobby B. smiles and replies, sure thing. As his tank is being filled, O'Brien asks, hey, don't I know you? Bobby B. replies, yeah. You went to Northside. O'Brien asks, can you check my oil, too? Bobby B. replies to O'Brien, sure. I can do that. No problem. Bobby B. pops the hood and checks the oil. Not quite sure of himself, Bobby B. repeats the procedure and checks the oil again. Seeing the same result, Bobby B. tells O'Brien, you're down at least 2 quarts. That's not good. O'Brien tells Bobby B., go ahead and fill it up with oil too. Bobby B. adds 2 quarts and rechecks the level. Adding another half quart, Bobby B. informs O'Brien, you were down 2.5 quarts. You might want to have Eddie take a look at your engine. O'Brien walks up to the service bays, telling Eddie, hey, can you come look at something for me? Eddie replies, yeah. In a minute. Wondering what today's problem is, Eddie walks outside and asks, what's up? Bobby B. explains, he was down 2.5 quarts of oil. Eddie replies, and there'll be a half a quart on the ground under his car when he starts his engine. The rear engine seal is leaking badly. Looking under the hood, Eddie tells O'Brien, you really should replace that battery. One of these days it's not going to start. Eddie then asks O'Brien, did Jake take a look at it? O'Brien replies, yeah. He told me to sell my car for scrap metal. I think he was jerking me around. Eddie tells O'Brien, look. I can fix it, but you have some serious stuff going on here. O'Brien asks, can you give me an estimate? Pointing to the first service bay, Eddie replies, sure. Pull it in front of that bay. O'Brien hands the money for his gas over to Bobby B. and gets in his car. O'Brien turns the key to start his engine. O'Brien's car, however, does not start. Not at all surprised, O'Brien tells Bobby B., it won't start. Bobby B. tells O'Brien, turn on your headlights. O'Brien turns on his headlights, prompting Bobby B. to inform him, wow. Your headlights put out about as much light as a nightlight. That's not good. Bobby B. opens the hood and looks at the inside of the battery. Giving O'Brien more bad news, Bobby B. informs him, your battery needs water, and your plates are warped. You need a new battery. O'Brien replies, I don't have the money right now. Bobby B. adds some water to the battery, hoping that will solve O'Brien's immediate problem. While Bobby B. is servicing O'Brien's battery, O'Brien asks Bobby B., how much does it cost to rotate the tires? Bobby B. replies, why do you want to do that? The tires rotate whenever the car is moving. O'Brien exclaims, I didn't mean rotating forward. Bobby B, quick with a comeback, replies, "If you want them to rotate backwards, then put the car in reverse." O'Brien, again, feels as if he is getting messed with, which he is. Bobby B tells O'Brien to start the car. This time, the car starts. O'Brien drives off, totally forgetting that Eddie was going to look at his engine, leaving a puddle of oil on the ground behind him. Or, perhaps, O'Brien drove away because Bobby B was messing with him. Either way, it's one less problem that Eddie will have to deal with today. Bobby B walks back into the service area, and Eddie tells him, "When you filled O'Brien's tank, you doubled the value of his car." Jake is right. He should just sell that piece of shit for scrap metal. Bobby B asks, "Who's Jake?" Eddie replies, "He's a mechanic on the other side of town. He's a nice guy. When Angelo first moved to this country, he worked for Jake for a while." Eddie and Bobby B get back to work, wondering when Jimmy O'Brien will return. Around lunchtime, Officer Richard Hayes drives into the service station, yelling out to Eddie, "What's up?" Eddie replies, "What's up?" Officer Hayes walks into the service area and, seeing Bobby B, asks, "Hey, are you working here now?" Bobby B replies, "Yeah. Part-time." Eddie, Bobby B, and Officer Hayes talk for a while, catching up on a few things before school starts. During the conversation, Officer Hayes mentions about that incident over there at the pool. This Terry Haynes character isn't doing too well. Bobby B asks, "Really? How bad is she?" Eddie sarcastically comments, "She was never doing any good to begin with." Richard explains, "After we placed her under arrest, we tried to get a statement out of her. She doesn't remember anything about what happened." Bobby B asks, "Really?" Richard elaborates, "Her skull was fractured, and she has a serious concussion." Erica was right. From the looks of things, she's not likely to ever fire a gun in the future. Eddie comments, "That girl has turned into a serious piece of work." Richard replies, "You guys are very lucky. The gun she had was fully loaded. And you'll never guess who the gun is registered to." Taking a wild guess, Eddie replies, "Goldshit." Richard replies, "Close." The gun comes back to a Stanley Goldstein, Andrew Goldstein's father. Bobby B replies, "Wow. This is getting interesting." Eddie asks, "So, how's the Chucky doing?" Richard replies, "He's not too good either. His mother wants you arrested." Eddie laughs and exclaims, "Me? I didn't do anything." Richard explains, "Somehow, she thinks that you instigated the whole thing." Eddie replies, "Yeah. I can hear this one in court." Edward, please describe your part in the incident that happened at the pool last summer. "I bought a gun, registered it to Goldschmidt's father, and gave it to Haynes. Then, I told Haynes exactly when to come to the pool to shoot all of us." "How else were you involved, Edward?" "I told Haynes to invite the Chucky too, because I wanted to watch him get his ass kicked before we all got shot." "Yeah, right. I don't think so." Richard laughs, telling Eddie and Bobby B, "Nothing will ever come of it. Brandishing a weapon is a serious charge. And this Haynes character is being charged with attempted kidnapping, since she attempted to remove Erica from the pool area. The DA will be throwing the book at them. The weapons charge will definitely stick." Bobby B replies, "Good." Richard then gives Eddie and Bobby B some advice, telling them, "If I were you guys, I would look into purchasing a weapon and getting some firearms training. Some of these characters around here have a screw loose." Bobby B replies, "After what happened, Erica's father gave her a 38. She already knows how to shoot." Richard replies, "Good." Eddie asks Richard, "Speaking of crazy people, did they ever find out what happened to McCrutchen during the divisional meet?" Richard shakes his head and replies, "You're not going to believe this one." Eddie laughs and tells Bobby B, this is going to be good. Richard explains, this Todd McCutcheon character took a high dose of codeine before the race to reduce pain, thinking he would have a better run. Adding fuel to the fire, McCutcheon also took a considerable amount of caffeine in pill form to give him extra energy. But it doesn't stop there. He used an asthma inhaler so he can breathe better. Apparently, that combination of drugs seriously affected his heart. He collapsed because he had some sort of heart rhythm problem. And it took the doctors a couple days to get him stabilized. They say he's lucky to be alive. Hearing Richard's description of what happened, Eddie exclaims, McCutcheon's father claimed that McCutcheon had a heart problem over a year ago. They blamed it on stress. Stress that McCutcheon claimed was caused by me, Mark, Braden, and everyone else. Richard replies, with these clowns, that doesn't surprise me. From what I see, you guys seem to be the target of a lot of this nonsense. And it's obviously because your team always wins. Eddie tells Richard, I'm changing my sign out by the street. I'm going to change it to, They, Incorporated. And the tagline will be, Blame Us for Everything. Bobby B. asks, What? Eddie explains, You know. Everyone always says stuff like, They robbed the store, or They are building a road here, or They don't have any information. Get it? Bobby B. laughs, replying, Yeah. Now I do. Richard laughs and tells Eddie, That's a good one. Richard then gets back on patrol, heading toward town to get some lunch. Once Officer Hayes drives away, Eddie tells Bobby B., Richard stops by a few times a week. If you have any interesting information, let him know. Bobby B. asks, So, that's how you always know everything that's going on? Eddie replies, Yeah. And Richard also drops a wanted vehicle list by occasionally, which has the description of vehicles that were stolen, involved in a hit and run, and that sort of thing. It's in the top drawer in the desk. Check it out sometime. Eddie and Bobby B. get back to work, wondering what they are going to be blamed for next.